say, we'd like to transfer you to the gas lab over at Plant A. Now, this is back to Dow Chemical. And I liked these guys so well. We played touch football. Bunch of people. And I didn't much want to leave at the time. It's kind of stupid to think about it. But anyway, I said, okay. So the next day, they shot me at the gas lab. And this is where they were analyzing. We had, by that time, built light hydrocarbon plant. Doc Wright was a very non-communicative. Walked by the wall Monday morning, got on, walked off, didn't say another word. Well, that's good enough. That's all you need to know. So I went to work research.
Is that when you moved into the organic lab?
Yeah, when I moved in organic. Really worked directly for Bobby Wall, which are in early, had about four or five people then. And we started off on a polymer project. He was trying to, you know, Dow up here was doing a lot of work on vinyl vinylidene chloride polymerization to make Saran. And Bobby Wall thought he had a better idea how to do that. And I was helping him set up and do a little polymerization there, which never did mount anything, and right off I could see that he didn't have anything. But I had to set up his equipment and do the experiments for him, and that lasted very short, and I went to something else. Bobby Wall went on to become a researcher for Monsanto. Mainly, he was very good at instruments, very good at equipment, all that kind of stuff, but wasn't too interested in carrying out the experiments. We'd set up a good, fine apparatus and all the instruments to go with it. Then he'd say, tear it down. I said, wait a minute, let's run an experiment in this thing. Well, it's not right, you know. All he was interested in, he was more physics. You know, physics, his interests were in instruments, physics, that kind of thing, not in the chemical part. And by the way, very good at it.
It's my understanding that when Dow first started in Texas, the research would be concentrated here in Midland.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We were not supposed to have any research in Texas. None whatever. That's right.
And how did that slowly change?
Well, okay, they built the light hydrocarbon plant, and then they built a glycol plant, alkaline oxide plant, and then some glycol, and then started getting in some chlorinated solvents, and they had to have some troubleshooting. So Mr. Roush, who had hired Earl Barnes down to run the glycol plant, he up here from Midland, who was in the special training course, decided that he had put him a troubleshooting. Well, before that, this was all in the middle of the war, you know. Right, everything was in the war, and I was in and out of 2A, 1A, and then the government kept demanding, you know, you're in magnesium, you just can't leave, you know. So all of us was working on magnesium. They just wouldn't let us go, you know. So they'd get a deferment and put us back. We'd go in 1A, and he'd come right back. You know, I never knew when I was going to go, but I guess it was a pretty essential occupation. And but also, we decided to bail the government. You know, they're needing synthetic rubber real bad, and special rubbers, particularly for gaskets and things. And this thiokol rubber all of a sudden became very important to the government, and they wanted Dow to build a thiokol rubber plant. So they pulled Earl Barnes off to start the building and the running of a thiokol plant. And we got this thing built and was training people and everything. Then they decided they didn't want it. So we never did start it up. And then about that time, Mr. Roush, who was the general manager of production, decided he needed a troubleshooting group. So he said, Earl, you set up a troubleshooting research group. And nobody, I don't think, had any trouble. They could see that that needed to be done, but no real research, just plant problems. But we very quickly started moving into research. And you see, we got no research money from Midland. The money, it all came out of Mr. Roush's production budget, everything. And we had to scramble and steal and, you know, equipment from other places. Anyway, we could get money to run on because we had no backing from Midland as far as research money. And but it just slowly developed, and finally we became probably the more dominant research group in the company in the 60s.
I have a note here. You did some early work on ethylene oxide polymerizations. Now I'm quoting, he learned the hard way. He had many unscheduled explosions before he learned how to remove the heat buildup.
Where'd you get this quote from?
That's from the Dow research history.
Oh, you mean reading the book?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, you see, I was assigned right off to Earl to look into alkaline oxides, their polymerization, what we're going to do with them, whether we're going to make ethers, or we're going to make glycols, what we're going to do with these things. You know, they had certain uses to make plain ethylene antifreeze. That was what they were rated for, antifreeze. Or sometimes the propylene was used for a defoaming agent, but that's all. The only person who knew anything about alkaline oxide was a guy named Staudinger over in Germany. Remember him? And I had read him, and he didn't have much to say, but he did know that alkali, like KOH or caustic and those kind of things, would polymerize. So I started doing this. My first experiments was in a big steam oven. That is big as that, only it's tall and about all the way to the floor, with big wooden doors with a big latch on it. And It was a steam oven. So I would take, I was working first with ethylene oxide. I would take ethylene oxide, put it in those vials, and chill it down, and I'd put in caustic and KOH and things like that. And then I'd seal them up, wrap them up in cloth towel or something, and put them in those ovens, see if they would thicken. And, well, they, time go on, you know, I'd look in there and I'd shake them to see how thick they're getting. Yeah, pretty thick. So one day I went in there and I looked, I had about four or five, big old tube about that big, about that long. And I shake it, see how thick this getting, and I said, well, I'll just move them up. Each shelf was a little hotter because of the steam set up. I had wrapped them back in their towel and put them up in another shelf and just shut the door, and it had taken about five steps and all those vials came apart. They blew up. Glass towels went through my legs and back. Didn't hurt me, but man, if I'd done, that had happened just a few seconds, it had been right in my face, you know. Well, I learned right a lot about oxides right quick, that you had to be careful with them and what would happen. And so I went through all this learning stage about how you have to, you got to polymer those things as you feed them in. You just can't go load up a big vial or a kettle full of this stuff because you blow it up, you know. And I did a lot of work on trying to make the butyl ether of propylene glycol with BF3 on a continuous basis. This works very fast, but you never could get all the fluorine out of the things where it caused corrosion, you know. But that was my early stages. And then this was in just kind of the lab. Then I moved over to this kind of a pilot plant area. In fact, I moved into a big old warehouse. What's the name of these?
The Butler
buildings. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and didn't even have a dirt floor in them. Well, my first lab I set up over there was in the crapper. Absolutely. I put a lattice rack. There's a great big building, and it had two stalls at the end. Well, it's a building maybe just about the size of this room. Scrapper down here, and I set me up a lattice rack over here. Couldn't stand that very long. Finally, I got me another lab and built it. Started doing all kind of things and trying to figure out what we were going to do with alkaline oxides. And we developed a series of ethylene glycols, polyethylene glycols, polyethylene, propylene, you know, go up to a certain molecular weight. And what was always puzzling to me, particularly in ethylene oxide, you'd make an E600, that's ethylene oxide, 600 molecular weight. You get that by end groups. One time it'd be liquid, and next time it'd be solid. And I said, what in the world? Why would this be? You know, all this is in the beginning when nobody knew it. Well, it was molecular distribution, see, which you had no way of really measuring. But anyway, I couldn't figure this out the longest. How one time I'd make these things, and I thought the same way, exactly the same way, and one of them would be a solid, one of them would be a liquid. And I couldn't figure out. But for some reason, somehow, something I did different, I'd change the distribution and get enough in there to make it solid.
How did you determine then that it was the distribution that was the cause of that?
Well, I think I started trying to skim out by temperature control the solids and measuring the molecular weights, you know, and it was very crude, I know, but we were pretty sure that's what it was. We didn't have any real good method of doing it other than just some sort of an oddball scheme, you know, that
Were you doing this on a small scale or a pilot? Was this at the pilot?
Well, it'd be in like 5 gallon kettles. I had several little 1 gallon, 5 gallon, 10 gallon, all the little autoclaves that I was doing this work in, where you'd feed the oxide in as fast as it polymerized to be sure you didn't blow up anything. Now, I come very close to blowing up something. See, we generally had these, you know, these, for ethylene oxide, we had these, not drum, but what am I trying to say, cylinders, about that tall, about that big around, and they stand quite a bit of pressure, and they had soft plugs in case something happened. But I'd gotten one time that had some vinyl chloride in it. Well, I took it and steamed it and washed it and steamed it and washed it. I knew I had it clean. Then I put ethylene oxide in it and filled it up with ethylene oxide, and then you use that to feed over into your kettle. Well, that had set there about a week. And somebody said, say, that cylinder out there, I was in my lab, is kind of jumping around. I dashed out there. Sure enough, that thing was just jumping all over the place. What it had done is blown its soft plug at the bottom. And it was just absolutely having a fit. But what, this is where I learned, one of the things I learned, see, there was enough zinc. See, those things are zinc lined. There was enough zinc chloride left. Very, you know, I'd steamed them. But there was enough zinc chloride in there to have started slowly but surely building temperature, pleo polymerization, to the point it got high enough that it set off a chain reaction. And it was right in that. And man alive, the top soft plug blew, and but that thing, it enlarged 3 inches, but didn't blow up. Well, that's where I learned, ionic chlorides will polymerize the heck out of oxides, you know, violently.
We'll come to that, but you did a lot of other work on ionic polymerization. Was that the first, your first?
Well, that was just one learning lesson. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one learning lesson.
I also have a note here. I think it was at this time that you had the first air-conditioned building in the Texas Division.
Yeah, right. This is where we decided to build a laboratory out of rice brick. Somebody had come up with a new deal where they were taking rice hulls, mixing concrete, and making a brick that had good insulation qualities. And it was experimental, but I needed a laboratory. I decided we'd just build us a lab with no windows and put rice brick, and it'd be cool. It's hot down there, you know. And we went out and scrambled up an old heater. Normally you put steam through it and you blow and heat things. Well, instead of putting steam through it, I ran pipes across the street to the one of the chlorinated solvent plants and tapped off of their brine. They had to have brine to run a lot of their distillation, you know. And I didn't tell anybody. I just tapped off the line, plugged it into my blower. Man, I had the best air-conditioned lab in the whole. Everybody came in there. It was nice. It was really nice. It's just perfect. And I could control that thing. And boy, everybody loved it. But finally, one time, the owner, old Tom Brown, traced that line on me. He gave me thunder. Then I had to start paying him for the use of the brine I was using. They put a meter on it.
How long did it take him to find
it? Oh, a long time. I think, I don't know, a year, 6 months.
Really?
Yeah. Before they ever detected. I don't know. They began to suspect they was losing brine somewhere, and they couldn't figure out where. And we did this one night, you know, when nobody was around. Oh, we did all kind of things to keep in existence at night. We made midnight requisitions everywhere on the production people, you know, and from each other, you know.
In 1946, you became project leader. That may already be the time that you're talking about, but I wanted to ask you about that. There was a series of positions, and I'm not sure what it was entailed with your responsibilities as project leader.
Well,
you're still within the organic.
Yeah, a project leader really is just the next step up where you are responsible for more than just your projects, and you've got, say, two or three, four maybe guys working for you. That way, you then can take on most of the projects or ones you want done, but you've got somebody else doing them for you or helping you. So I would have, as a project leader, probably four people helping me.
And it was at that time you also went to Brooklyn Poly.
Yeah. Well, okay.
For a few weeks.
But in the interim, you see, I don't know how these questions come, but we set out to make a series of polyglycols, you know, good, solid, water white polyglycol for antifreeze, for other uses that would be stable, you know, stable, and they wouldn't have a bitter taste. Boy, taste is one of the important things in polyglycols, and for that matter, in antifreeze, or particularly the ones that goes into extracts and tobacco and stuff. You know, you got that aftertaste is just absolutely better beyond. Well, this is generally propylene, but it can be aspartame. But so we worked on all that to refine the quality of the glycols. Then we started making the glycol derivatives, particularly for our surfactants and detergents. That was our goal, to make good surfactants and detergents for de-emulsifiers, for the oil industry, detergents, even maybe for, you know, washing powders, but mainly for industrial detergents, what we were really aiming at. Then we got involved, I'm not sure just the sequence of these, in synthetic lubricants.
Okay.
And we got hooked up with Standard Oil of California. See, at that time, boy, you take up, well, like today, or particularly up in Alaska and Canada, you couldn't hardly run your car in the wintertime. Absolutely couldn't run it. Most people ran them on kerosene, you know, and that's very poor lubricating oil, you know. Or they take kerosene, put a little oil in it, you know. A terrible situation, most. And so Standard Oil had a lot of business in Alaska and Canada, high north, Montana. So they wanted a synthetic lubricant. So we started looking into this. And we could make very, very good lubricants with high viscosity index. But they weren't stable enough. You'd run them a while and they'd get acid, you know. So we had to go to working on how to build these things and make them stable, and we did. We got some very good-looking synthetic lubricants. And we got to the point, see, I've made many a trip out to Standard Oil there in Oakland. Anyway, this fellow Hughes, you may know this name, from Ohio, came in and gave this big presentation on VI improvers. And I remember this conference well, where everybody thought, well, this is just false rethinking. There's nothing to this. Others, yeah, it is. Hughes was very defensive of it. And, of course, I just sat mainly and listened. But all the experts on the oil business, there was a big divided camp of whether this meant anything or not. But it meant a heck of a lot. Because it was real. You know, and we've used them slowly but ever since. Well, that put us out of the synthetic lubricant business. Now you can take a regular oil, thin enough that you can run it, but you can thicken it to where it'll run with high heat. And that just eliminated us as a VI, as a synthetic lubricant business. If that hadn't come along, we'd have been big in that thing. Man, we had a good deal. But they didn't need it, too costly. And this was so much cheaper. And it turned out it was real, and it just went on and was a good deal. But in this period, Joe Baggin and I kept fiddling with... I just knew that somehow ionic compounds and salts and things, you know, we used BF3 and we'd used zinc chloride and we started trying to figure out, well, zinc chloride is very volatile. Man, it is potent stuff, you know, almost everything. And then we tried, well, maybe ferric chloride. But even ferric chloride, raw ferric dropped in PO is violent, you know. So we started getting acetone solution, cooling it down to acetone, about a minus 20 or something, you know, and slowly dropping acetone in there and getting polymer. Well, that's still not very good, but what we found out was that, okay, we make this polymer, and we pull this, it makes a kind of a brown stuff. If we take this out and extract it and dry it, then we've got a catalyst that's much more controllable. And so we slowly came up with this complex that a lot of other people would have come up with, you know, by just kind of a serendipity, you know.
I think you have a patent on that, as
yeah.
I recall.
Yeah, we have a patent on this catalyst. And we'd make this, and the way we'd make the polymer most of the time would be to take a rotating autoclave of 5-10 gallons and cool it down with acetone solution or some other cooling just through a pipe. And we would put the required amount of ferric chloride complex in there and seal it off right quick. Then it would go through an exerm. And a lot of people thought, boy, you're going to blow one of these up sometime. But it'd go through an exerm. Boy, and then just quit. And then it'd polymerize. But this exerm never blew up anything. It just went so far, and that was it. And we had it under good control. You know, we got to where we knew exactly what this was going to be. So we could run pretty sizable hunks of stuff because it always come out the same. And we would